Listeners are advised that today's episode of Lines of Inquiry contains details of a disturbing and sexually graphic nature. Listener discretion is advised. It is January 2016. I'm sitting at my cramped desk at Garda headquarters in Dublin, in the corner of the document and handwriting examination section. There's a large working area behind me, in the centre of the room, but I like to work at my desk, cocooned from distraction and able to focus on my task. My microscope sits on the desk, but I don't use it much. There's a stack of paper files beside it, with all manner of cases in them. My desk is old and wooden. The red carpet under my feet is threadbare. The wallpaper on the wall over my desk is peeling in spots. There's no glamour here. This isn't high-tech. My work is a very human skill. I analyse handwriting. I place two sealed evidence bags on my desk. What is inside will become part of the longest and most disturbing case in all my time as a detective Garda in the handwriting section. Wearing my examination gloves, I slowly remove the pages from the envelope. There are a lot of them, 30 pages. I place them on the desk and start to read. My twisted plans are to abduct, torture, rape, and kill one college girl per month. My prey will be pretty girls aged 18 to 25. I will keep their bodies for my pleasure. I like to make love to them and have sex with them until the maggots would come. College girls should start feeling afraid because I'm coming to get them soon. I buried her where they would not find her. The shape of the words, the constructions of the letters, that ballpoint pen ink filling the A4 pages, and the deviant evil on the page. It's triggering something instant in me. It's all hauntingly familiar. I have seen this before. He's back. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, this was me. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to read the silent witnesses at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints wiped from surfaces, ligatures hidden in plain sight, handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story, and now I'm telling you. In this new podcast from Go Loud, join me inside some of Ireland's most haunting stories. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, presents the evidence step by step, and discovers the truth behind the investigations. In this episode, the Midlands Letters case. A story of how a series of anonymous letters spread panic and fear across the middle of Ireland. It's the story of a man driven by pent-up rage and a sick obsession, and the race against time to find him. In 2007, after 10 years working in the fingerprint section of the Garda Technical Bureau, I felt the itch for a change. I was a fully qualified fingerprint expert. I'd attended many crime scenes, including murders, drug seizures, fatal fires, and countless burglaries, and I'd given expert evidence in numerous trials. But now I wanted something new. I wanted to further sharpen my natural eye for detail. I wanted to perfect my ability to decipher the sometimes hidden clues in the jumble of evidence we take from certain crimes. I knew there was a vacancy in a particular little corner of the Technical Bureau, in the Document and Handwriting Examination section. There, detectives pored over documents like passports, identity cards, driving licenses, and currencies to determine if they were real or counterfeit. But the discipline that appealed most to me was handwriting examination. The skill to scrutinise handwriting and signatures with the end goal of determining if a suspect had written them. Handwriting comparison is a time-consuming exercise. It's not just the construction of each individual letter that's looked at. Letters can and will be written differently depending on where they lie within a word, or if they are connected to other letters. Humans are not machines. so we never write exactly the same way twice. In examining a suitably large volume of writing, a handwriting expert is trying to develop a snapshot of all the variations in a person's normal handwriting, and then compare their findings to a sample they know that a person wrote. It's really an analysis of variances. Much like fingerprints, handwriting has its own individual identity, and it is a handwriting expert's job to unmask it. If it was written and somebody needed to know who it was that wrote it, they came to us. There's a bit of mythology around handwriting analysis. Some people, even some police departments around the world, have these ideas that you can see into a person's personality, maybe their soul, through their handwriting. It's called graphology, and it's all bullshit. There's no credible research to back it up. Just because a person writes a certain way doesn't mean they're trustworthy or deceitful or psychotic. Handwriting analysis is a craft, a skill. It's a methodical science in many ways. But it's one where a keen, well-trained eye can spot almost imperceptible clues that reveal the truth behind the words. My job wasn't to peer inside someone's soul. It was to show their face. We worked on all kinds of cases. One day you might be looking at a list of names and debts scrawled in a notebook taken in a raid on a drug dealer's home. The next day you might have to trawl the notebooks of fellow Gardaí when there were suspicions of falsified records. It went from the more mundane stuff like forged checks and falsified legal documents, right to the nastier, darker side of the job. At the lower end of the nasty stuff you had what we'd call the nuisance letters. They'd range from someone sending threatening notes over something like a garden boundary dispute, or to people anonymously alleging affairs and all sorts. And then there was the darker stuff. The letters sent covered in all manner of body fluid. The threats to kill. The words written with the aim of making someone fear for their existence. And the suicide letters. They were always the toughest. Whatever case I worked on, I learned how to approach it. How to make sure I never brought it home. My job wasn't to analyze the content of what was on the page. It was to unmask who wrote it. It was a job I loved, and I stayed there for 16 years. And for most of my cases, I was able to stay away from the words. But not all of them. I was there 8 years or so when I began what was to become the most disturbing case I would work on in all my years as a Garda Technical Bureau detective. A case that Gardaí, including myself, would come to call the Midlands Letters case. It began for me in November 2015. I was sitting at that very same cramped desk at Garda headquarters, tucked away in the corner like always, at peace poring over the individual strokes of letters, the gaps between them, and seeing what clues could be found on the page. It was my turn to take on a fresh case. I went to the pile of evidence waiting to be examined and took the next case on the pile. Chance in a way. I carried the evidence bag to my desk and sat down. Wearing my examination gloves, I carefully opened it and removed a thick bundle of handwritten pages. It was an anonymous letter sent to the Institute of Technology in Athlone, County Westmeath. What was inside was concerning enough that local Gardaí had sent it to us for further examination. There were 23 pages of lined A4 paper, all handwritten. The writing was neat, in the unmistakable writing medium of a ballpoint pen. The words filled the A4 pages. The first sentence read, "My plans to abduct female college students." 23 pages, each filled with depraved descriptions and threats of extreme violence and murder. The author wrote of plans to abduct female students. They wrote about sexual torture and slow, drawn-out death for their victims. They vowed to abduct, torture, rape and kill. They spoke about their ambition to be a serial rapist and killer. Some of the pages showed photos of girls cut from newspapers, as well as pornographic images. There was rage in the words. Rage and a deep, terrifying depravity. This was a horror film come to life, sitting on my desk. Each new page I read was a window into a sick, dangerous mind. I am stalking a number of college girls at the moment. I have developed some extreme sexual fantasies for twisted, depraved sexual torture. I have it all planned. I have a place to take the girls, a soundproof and escape-proof torture den where no one will hear their screams of terror. It was unsigned, but its intentions were clear. The desire to harm and kill young women. Even for a seasoned handwriting expert like me, this was not normal. This was something darker, as if from somewhere else. But it was real, and I was holding it in my hands. Threats of this nature couldn't be dismissed as just the ramblings of a sick mind. Here was someone glorifying his twisted desires and sharing his ambitions for more. Maybe what struck me most was the volume of it. 23 pages. To be able to write this kind of thing for 23 pages, by hand, that told me as much as the words. This was somebody obsessed, someone consumed completely by their demons. As a seasoned handwriting expert, the task at hand was to unmask the author hiding behind these pages. My job was never to analyse the content of what I read, it was to examine the handwriting. But sometimes you can't help asking bigger questions. Had these acts already happened, or were these pages just the works of a deviant fantasy? If it was fantasy, how long before it became reality? Not long, I suspected. I knew we needed to find the writer of these letters, and I feared our time was running out. What would follow would become one of the most unnerving investigations of my entire career. Sat there in November of 2015, with this large volume of writing before me, I was satisfied very early on that the handwriting in this letter was not disguised. Keeping that consistent level of subterfuge throughout would be far too difficult to maintain, especially in the torrent of sexually violent words scribbled across the pages. I was very sure from the start it was a man behind these letters. It may seem obvious, but of course you have to keep an open mind. After reading the first letter, I didn't hold much doubt. He wrote of having prepared a soundproof and escape-proof torture chamber, and of how he would become a new serial rapist and killer. In sickening detail, he described the various implements that he had collected, with which he would carry out his twisted fantasies. Cable ties and handcuffs, blindfolds and mouth gags, chains and whips. He even boasted of constructing an electric shock device using jump leads and breast clamps. He wrote that he had a tape recorder to capture the girl's screams. And it got worse somehow. Syringes for injecting semen, chains, hoists and meat hooks. A suitable site to bury bodies. No detail appeared to have been overlooked in drawing up his horrifying plans. Alongside the words, there were many pornographic images glued to the pages. Often when we received a letter with sexual or violent threats, the person the author wrote about was the recipient of the letter. This was different. One page showed a photograph of Karen Buckley, a 24-year-old student from Cork who had been murdered in Glasgow earlier that year. She was studying occupational therapy at Glasgow Caledonian University. She had a bright future. Karen was brutally murdered by Alexander Pactow, a 21-year-old from Glasgow. After meeting Karen at a nightclub, he bludgeoned her with a spanner and strangled her in his car, before hiding her body in a barrel at a farm. Pactow was jailed for a minimum of 23 years. The haunting details from that crime were fresh in everybody's minds. Pactow's sentencing was just 2 months before this letter was sent. The author was now promising that Karen's horrific suffering would be mild compared to what he had planned for his victims. In lengthy detail, he even described what he would have done to Karen. I would have made Karen suffer in agony with some of the most extreme, horrific sexual torture. Raped over and over, he wrote. Another page carried a picture of Jill Marr. Jill was another young Irish woman murdered abroad. The 29-year-old journalist from Drogheda in County Louth was raped and murdered while walking home from a pub in Melbourne, Australia, in the early hours of the 22nd of September 2012. Her killer was Adrian Bailey, a 41-year-old serial rapist who was out on parole when he killed the young Irish woman, in a case that shocked Ireland and Australia. And as I read, I found our poisonous pen letter writer salivating over these gruesome murders. What Jill suffered would be mild compared to what she suffered with me, he wrote. I have read these letters and I can't bring myself to repeat the sick language and graphic accounts of torture and suffering he had imagined for these two young women. He also boasted of having gotten away with raping an unnamed 19-year-old student and fantasized about what he thought had happened to 18-year-old Deirdre Jacob, who had disappeared without trace near her home in Newbridge, County Kildare, on the 28th of July, 1998. As a seasoned Garda, I had already witnessed several gruesome crime scenes and investigated many disturbing handwriting cases, but I'd never seen anything like this. But I knew that, besides these pages, we had nothing to go on. To unmask a writer, I needed a sample of writing from a suspect to compare against. And right then we had no leads, no suspects. We had nothing but these pages. I examined the pages of the letter with the ESDA, which is the electrostatic development apparatus. That's a machine that makes it possible to develop invisible indentations on paper, left unknowingly by a writer. These are marks that can transfer from a page above the one that's written on, maybe a faint tracing of a partial address or a phone number, even a name. But the machine found none. These pages gave up no hidden secrets. I had nothing. I sent the long letter to the Forensic Science Laboratory, where a full DNA profile was generated from it. But again, a search against the DNA database drew a blank. It was the same with fingerprints. We found traces of them, and the detectives in the fingerprint section developed finger marks, but there were no hits against the National Fingerprint Collection. Whoever the author was, he had never come to the attention of the Gardaí before. Our sick writer had never had to provide a DNA sample or a set of fingerprints. I had put the letters through the full analysis, wielding all of the power of our technology, and came up with nothing. Frustrated, I compiled my brief report to that effect. No clues, no leads, not much hope. But the words on the pages stayed with me. This was a dangerous individual. But at that moment it was an isolated case, and potentially a one-off moment of madness. I filed the case away and tried to focus on other cases landing on my desk. I was drawn back into this case just 2 months later, when in January 2016, two more anonymous letters arrived for analysis. As I looked at them, I knew. I don't need to compare all aspects of the writing or study every individual letter structure. Sometimes you just know. And I knew instinctively, these new letters were written by the same person who had written the first. He was back. The first of these two new letters ran over 30 pages long. In it, the author boasted of having raped his daughter and a niece over a period of 4 years, starting when his daughter was only 11 years old, an innocent child. He also claimed he had made the little girl pregnant. Did either the daughter or the niece actually exist? We didn't know. He wrote in nauseating detail of abusing his niece on her confirmation day and how he told her it was a special present. Again, just like in the first letter, there were pages about his preteen fantasies and his obsession with teenage girls. He listed 11 different named girls and what he had done to them. He wrote about stalking girls between the ages of 15 and 16 across the Midlands and parking near schools and masturbating outside them. He also wrote about necrophilia, having sex with corpses. He declared that his ultimate thrill would be to whip, rape and kill, or to suffocate a victim with a plastic bag. And again, the sheer volume of it all, page after page filled with this stuff. Like with the first letter, the thickness of the pile of pages told its own story of this man's complete obsession. He was prolific. I thought to myself, this guy is different. He's dedicated. He's boasting. He wants us to read this. He craves the attention. Another letter was found by a member of the public on September 26, 2015. It was stuck to a wooden rail outside Tullamore Garda Station. It was just as disturbing. In it, he told of his intention to abduct and kill a pregnant girl. He also made a chilling declaration. I am the person who killed pretty Fiona Pender in August 1996. He wrote how he had strangled her, tortured her, and buried her naked body in a deep grave. Fiona was 25 years old and 7 months pregnant when she disappeared from her home in Tullamore, County Offaly, on the 23rd of August 1996. Gardaí had included her in Operation Trace, a large-scale investigation into several highly publicised disappearances in an area that became collectively known as Ireland's Vanishing Triangle. Deirdre Jacob, who he had previously written about, is also among these women who disappeared without a trace in this supposed Vanishing Triangle. The writer claimed he had kept Fiona's body for several days after killing her, before, in his words, "I buried her where she would never be found." Fiona Pender's disappearance would finally be upgraded to a murder investigation in 2025. Regardless of what theories Gardaí might have had about Fiona's fate at the time, this letter, and the ones before it, needed to be taken very seriously. I knew we were dealing with someone more dangerous than any run-of-the-mill anonymous letter writer, and he was nowhere near finished. In all, we now had three equally graphic and disturbing anonymous letters by the one author. I began to wonder, given the length of each letter and the short time span in which he had sent them, had any others come to the attention of the Gardaí? The mystery writer was certainly prolific enough in his endeavours. Could these really be the only ones? With that in mind, and growing ever more frustrated with our lack of progress, and fearful of what might be coming next, I decided to do some investigating of my own. Just a few days after reading those two letters, I decided I needed to go to the archives. I set about trawling through the records of previous anonymous letters received from Midlands Garda stations. I found many, all logged in hardback ledgers containing masses of paper records going back to the 1970s. It was an old filing system. There was no effective computer search tool to find what you needed, and the only way to go through them was one by one. So I did, opening each ledger and finding the cases that contained anonymous letters. But each time I came across one, a cursory look at the copies of the letters told me that they weren't the work of our faceless would-be serial killer and rapist. Again and again, this was not who I was looking for. It wasn't quite like looking for a needle in a haystack. There weren't masses of anonymous letters from the Midlands in those years, but it was still a slow process that took many hours. I went back month by month, year by year, and with each dead end I drifted further from the letters of the past few months, and, I presumed, further from the hope of uncovering another of his works. And then I came to an entry in the records from early in 2004, 12 years before our writer had come to our attention. I retrieved the file from the ledger. It was thick with photocopies of handwritten pages. I read the words and stared at the scrawl of the pen, and I knew. Sometimes you just know. The writing clicked. This was him. The style, spacing, letter constructions, and the disturbing content matched perfectly with the other cases. Before I started to read it in full, I spotted something else in the file, something that would add another layer. There was a typed report, which had been compiled by one of the Gardaí from Tullamore. The report detailed how the author of this letter, the one from 2004, had gone beyond his writing and constructed something tangible and real, a potential playground in which to act out his fantasies. As I read, I wondered if these words could be more than depraved fantasies. On Sunday, the 22nd of February, 2004, two schoolboys aged 12 and 14 had been playing in a forest in Cloncollig, a rural townland to the east of Tullamore town. There they came across something unusual in the woods. They went home and told their parents. The parents called Gardaí, and the following day, a local Garda went to investigate. On foot, he had to cross the railway line and the farmland adjacent to the woods. Upon reaching the trees, he continued south into the dark woods. He walked until he found what the boys had seen, a large dustbin that had been partially concealed in a furrow in the ground. There was a strong smell coming from it. The bin was covered with a black lid, and there was plastic wrapped around it and beneath it. A pointed shovel and a flat-bladed spade were lying next to it. Nearby, the Garda saw a notice board which somebody had nailed to a tree. Someone had wrapped this in clear plastic too. And beneath the plastic were newspaper and magazine cuttings showing females in various stages of undress. More newspapers were unfolded on the forest floor where someone had used the spot as a toilet. The Garda noticed lower branches of the trees had been cut away to create a pathway. It was not the natural track made by a deer or some other animal. Someone had made this pathway through the trees. The Garda stood alone in the quiet forest and opened the half-buried bin. Inside was a handsaw, a hammer, a length of rope, adult nappies, and numerous pornographic magazines, all wrapped in plastic. And there was a biscuit tin, sealed with sellotape. And in this tin, there was a handwritten letter. From what I could see in the file, there was never anything more learned about what the Garda had discovered that day. It had remained a mystery. But we had the letter. And 11 years later, I held a copy of it in my hands. The letter began, "My sins. Commencing May 2005, I will go out on Saturday evenings, driving around, hunting for my prey. I will survey the area to make sure no one else is around. Then I will abduct my prey from the roadside, knocking them out with a blow to the head with a hammer." The writer continued, promising to keep his victims captive in the woods, returning every day to rape them, before finally strangling them and burying them. The sordid and explicit content rambled on. I had grown accustomed to his endless descriptions of horrific sexual fantasies, but the last few pages showed just how married he was to his plan. He compiled detailed timetables, what time to go out hunting for young girls and women, how long to spend searching for victims, how much time it would take to subdue them. He timed how long it would take to undress them, place them in the bin and secure it. He had plans for burying all his victims. He had lists of the distances to his chosen hunting grounds and the time it would take to get there. Clara, Port Arlington, Mount Mellick, Burr and Moat were just some of the places selected. It was a portrait of meticulously planned madness and of a particularly disciplined kind of evil. He had it all worked out, and worked out as far back as 2004, 12 years before his current spate of letters. Across 20 pages, the author wrote of his obsession with teenage schoolgirls, nappies and sanitary towels. One page showed a photo of two named schoolgirls from Cork, cut from a newspaper. He also listed over 70 names, which he referred to as nice names for naughty girls. But the most chilling of all was his detailed plans to find, kidnap, torture and kill. There was so much deep thought gone into it, and so much detail. This new discovery led to a new raft of questions. Had all of this been simmering away in the writer's head for over a decade? Had he acted out on any of his sick obsessions in that time? Fantasist or not, this man had to be identified. I contacted each Garda who had sent me on each of the three letters, informing them of the existence of every letter so far, and of my certainty that they came from the same person. I told them that if any further letters came to light, they were to be sent directly to me, so I could group everything together. The investigating Gardaí and I worked to create some kind of profile, based off what we had seen, and some educated guesses. So what did we know? Well, letter writing is a dying art, especially among the younger generation. And from what we could see, this person was not tech-savvy. The newspaper cuttings, the pictures torn from pornographic magazines, all low-tech methods of work, the patience to sit and write for such long periods of time, also hinted that this was not a young person. We felt confident that this was a middle-aged man. And throughout 2016 and into 2017, the letters kept coming. Some were sent directly to Garda stations. Another was flagged by unpussed sorting staff. Yet another was found by a member of the public, fixed to a railing in the Slieve Blooms, in which the writer talked again of killing Fiona Pender. In this letter, he even gave himself a title, "The Beast of All Sex Beasts." In the periods of time between each new letter, I would go back to my other work, leaving the investigating Gardaí in the Midlands to continue their hunt. I would put this man out of my mind, falling back on my years of experience that let me lock it away. And then things changed. Two new letters arrived. One was sent to Our Lady's Bower Secondary School in Athlone, and another to the Sacred Heart School in Tullamore. Both schools were for girls only. Within them was something we hadn't seen before. something that would make this all feel very real. In those letters to the school, he singled out six pupils, six teenage girls, not figments of his imagination, innocent young girls who had now been drawn unwittingly into this hideous spectacle. He named them, and he boasted of how he has been watching them, stalking them. He said he knew where they lived. He wrote all of this to the school staff, taunting them. If we as a police force ever had the refuge of believing this might not be real, and it might always stay as someone's sick fantasy, that was shattered in these pages. He wrote, "I am writing this to warn the principal and teachers of my twisted and sadistic plans to start abducting a number of teenage schoolgirls. My plans are to abduct, rape, torture and kill pretty 15 and 16-year-old naughty schoolgirls and bury them in a secret location after I kill them and fulfill my extreme fantasies." With those words and the six names, we knew this had entered a new realm. Even before this, Gardaí had deployed significant resources to the job of tracking the letter writer, but we still had no clue where to start looking. And then, finally, there was a breakthrough. Gardaí traced the serial numbers from the stamps on the envelopes in which some of the letters were sent. This doesn't always work, often the numbers are illegible, but this time, the investigating Gardaí got the lead we'd been searching for. With those serial numbers, they were able to identify where some of the letters had been sent from. A post office in Tullamore. We had a location, and we were pretty sure we had a rough age group to look at. We were finally getting somewhere. The investigating Gardaí went to the post office and painstakingly trawled through hours of CCTV footage in the hope of identifying individuals who just might be our man. While that was underway, Gardaí interviewed several people, including some who lived near where the den or hide had been found in 2004. I was forwarded handwriting specimens from 8 different individuals. The specimens were a good mix of incidental or course of business writings, like forms and business letters, and also request specimens, the content of which was dictated to the writers by the Gardaí. The specimens were taken in the hope we might be able to spot a match with the handwriting in the anonymous letters. I examined them all. With one, I thought we might have something. I couldn't rule out that it might be a match. But that hope was extinguished when I got a second, larger sample in and realized it wasn't him. There was the hope that the examination of the CCTV footage from the post office might unlock it all for us. But despite the many hours of work put in by investigators, that offered nothing new. Despite it all, the trail still ran cold. It was now March 2017, and frustration had set in. I had thought we had found our breakthrough and found myself no closer to unmasking the letter writer. Then one of the investigating Gardaí from Tullamore attempted one last throw of the dice. In what would turn out to be an inspired bit of good police work, he decided to show the CCTV footage from the post office to a retired colleague. This ex-Garda had served the force for many years in and around the Tullamore area and had decades of local knowledge under his belt. He watched those same hours upon hours of camera footage, seeing various people going about their business. Several of them had already been interviewed and cleared of any involvement in the writing of the anonymous letters. But then he noticed something. He paused the playback. A familiar face, there for just a second. Blink and you'd miss it. The retired detective pointed at the face on the screen. "Has he been looked at?" he asked. "No," came the answer. Pointing at the frozen image, the detective said, "That fella there, he's always been a bit of an oddball." They both looked at the screen. "His name," the retired detective said, "is Liam Finley." A new suspect had emerged in the case, and his name was Liam Finley. Finley was a part-time construction worker in his mid-40s from Clonminch, on the outskirts of Tullamore town, where he lived with his elderly father. The area itself is filled with families who live side by side in pebble-thatched terraced homes. It was only a short distance, across several fields, to where the first hide or den had been found in a wooded area in 2004. For starters, Tullamore Gardaí obtained a specimen of Findlay's handwriting without his knowledge. It was made up of claim forms and an application for a job seeker's allowance means test. These forms didn't contain a large amount of writing, but what was there was enough for me to confirm the retired detective's hunch. The individual letter constructions, their proportions relative to where they appeared within words, the spacing of them, and the height of the writing relative to the lines on the pages. They were all consistent with what I'd seen throughout the many, many pages of the anonymous letters. I was sure, but I still conducted a full comparison, sketching each letter and their variants. I hadn't come this far not to make sure my analysis was 100% correct. At last, I was sure beyond any doubt. We had found the beast of all sex beasts. Conclusions in handwriting comparison cases are typically expressed on what we call a scale of opinion. It can go from inconclusive, to limited, to strong, depending on how sure you are that the same person wrote different samples of writing. In my report on Findlay's samples compared against the letters, I put it at the very top of the scale, a conclusive. I sent it on to Gardaí and Tullamore, letting them know it was my expert opinion that the anonymous letters matched the writing samples taken from Liam Findlay, and the chances of it being someone else who wrote the letters were so remote that it could be discounted. In making the match, much like when I had worked in the fingerprint section, identifying finger marks at crime scenes, I felt a surge of adrenaline, and also relief. Now I knew who the mysterious author actually was. If any further letters came to light, I wouldn't be groping around in the dark. Liam Findlay was our man. All of my long examinations and comparisons had paid off. Now we were sure he was the writer, Gardaí and Tullamore kept a close eye on Findlay over the next couple of months, as they built a solid case before eventually approaching him at his home. At 6:30 a.m. on a June morning in 2017, Gardaí arrived at Findlay's front door. He was home when they knocked. At first he denied everything, but a search of the house revealed a mountain of fresh evidence. There were 994 newspaper cuttings. 45 of them were young women. Many were local women. With their pictures, he had names and phone numbers. A grey bin in the home contained female clothes and a map of Ireland. There were biscuit tins with more of his twisted letters and a cardboard box of adult porn magazines. There were more clippings about the murder trial of Graeme Dwyer in 2015. Dwyer had murdered 36-year-old Elaine O'Hara in 2012. Dumping her body on Killachie Mountain in South Dublin. Other finds included two books on convicted rapist Larry Murphy. Even more damning was the discovery of the rape kit we had read about in the letters. This was not a figment of his imagination or an unrealized fantasy. It held two ropes, two scissors, cable ties, condoms, a wooden spade, pseudocream and a syringe. Gardaí who searched the house would later describe it as eerie. It seemed that our earlier assumptions were correct. Findlay was middle-aged and steadfastly old-school. No computer equipment was found in the house. He had left school after his intermediate certificate, and the only other education he underwent was a safety course so he could work on building sites. The 47-year-old was arrested there and then and taken away. His claims of innocence soon evaporated, and he admitted his guilt during interviews with investigating Gardaí. During those interviews, he made a chilling admission. He had just recently finished constructing a new den, or hide, in another area called Meelahan's Wood, acres of then undeveloped land with clusters of dense woodland, which lay slightly further from Tullamore town than the location of his first den, found in 2004. Findlay led Gardaí to this new location. It was so dense with brush and undergrowth that they had to crawl on their hands and knees to reach a small clearing where Findlay had done some levelling to the ground and cut back some of the vegetation. In the middle of this area, he had built a hut. It was a sturdy construction, measuring 8 foot by 15 foot and covered in plastic. The plastic and the surrounding trees meant that the hut was well protected from the elements. A saw, shovel and other equipment used in its construction were still there. And in the hut, Gardaí found more newspaper clippings of young women. It would be another year before Findlay eventually appeared before Judge Keenan Johnson at Tullamore Circuit Court in June of 2016 on charges of threatening to abduct, torture, rape and kill teenage girls in the Midlands. Findlay had been in custody since his arrest in June of 2017 and had been refused bail as Gardaí argued he posed a very real danger. Liam Findlay pleaded guilty. I had been chomping at the bit to present my findings to the court, but since Findlay had pleaded guilty, I wouldn't get the chance. I wouldn't get to sit in the witness box and see the man whose actions had led me to becoming embroiled in one of the largest and most disturbing handling cases of my career. More importantly, however, the parents of the six girls named in the letter that he had sent to the Sacred Heart School in Tullamore had a chance to speak in court. In their victim impact statements, they spoke of their shock and confusion and of how they worried about their daughter's safety. Their statements laid bare the terror those letters had spread for the victims. The young girls and their parents had no idea who the writer was or what he might do. One girl lived in constant fear that she was being watched and wouldn't go anywhere alone. Her parents described her as a completely different girl since the letters came to light. They told the court she had self-harmed since it all began. Another of the girls wouldn't go to school unless her parents brought her there and collected her right at the door. Yet another wouldn't sleep in her own room, instead always sleeping in a separate room with her mother. She would go around the house at night, checking that the windows and doors were locked. Sleepovers for the girls had become a thing of the past. Liam Findlay was found guilty of the possession and distribution of child pornography and of sending packages containing obscene material by post. But it would be another year before Judge Keenan Johnson handed down his sentence. The judge wanted a full psychological assessment of Findlay before announcing his decision. One of the psychiatrists who treated Findlay while he was on remand in prison, Dr. Breeder Wright, believed he presented a significant risk of further offending when returned to the community. She listed several factors, including sexual deviation and relationship problems. She noted that the building of the second den just weeks before his arrest and the presence of the rape kit in his house were signs of a significant escalation in his apparent sexual behaviour. It was also mentioned that the death of his mother in 2015 had been a terrible blow to Findlay, and it was at this time that there was a noted increase in his writing of obscene and threatening letters. Dr. Wright went on to describe Findlay as socially isolated, saying he appears to have led a very isolated and sheltered life and did not mix with his peers except when necessary while working. She said he was on the autism spectrum and had difficulty with social engagements. Her ultimate diagnosis was that Findlay was suffering from sexual sadism disorder. Before announcing sentence, Judge Johnson commented that although Findlay's litany of boasts and claims of having abducted, raped and killed many young women were all fantasy, his actions, particularly in the building of the dens, showed a significant amount of premeditation and planning. He described the case as one of the most bizarre, extreme and disturbing cases that I have ever had to deal with. It is like something from a Stephen King novel or a horror film. He added, it is frightening and disturbing that someone could take pleasure in authoring the perverse fantasies contained in his poisonous correspondences. He sentenced Findlay to 15 years in prison, with the final three suspended for a period of 10 years. He would also be placed on the sexual offenders register. A further condition was that on release he must not reside in County Offaly, County Westmeath or County Leash. This would not only be for the peace of mind of the people affected by his offences, but also for Findlay's own safety, in case he was attacked by vigilantes. After the court case, one of the investigating Gardaí described Findlay as ticking time bomb. Knowing now what we do about how he appeared to be preparing to move his crimes from his letters and into the real world, I think back to reading that very first letter, and the thought that we knew so little and didn't know how much time we had. The public rarely hears about crime prevention, even though it's often more important than crime investigation. This was the case with the Midlands Letters investigation. The combined effort of the tenacious investigating Gardaí, the forensic lab, and the handwriting section might just have stopped a ticking time bomb from going off. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, sharing it on social media, or telling a friend. Make sure to follow the show in your podcast app. Your support helps us to keep exploring these important cases. Lines of Inquiry is a Go Loud original podcast presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan, and Siobhan Walsh is our producer. Sound editing and design are by Neil Kavanagh. This episode was written by Owen Brennan, Siobhan Maguire, and myself, John Sweetman. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light. In the next episode of Lines of Inquiry, the killing of 11-year-old Robert Holohan, a community's worst nightmare, a frantic search that gripped the nation, and a devastating secret that lay close to home.